We want to once again welcome everybody. We don't have as much, as many submissions today as we had yesterday. So we are a lot earlier than we could have been. Nonetheless, we still have work to do for most of the money. We also today want to acknowledge the National Secretary, which is joining us for this public hearing. Of course, National Secretary has a huge role to play in so far as the represented political justice funds who has the quantum of money available therein. With that, Chair, I want to hand over to you to comment the process.
Thank you, CEO, and ladies and gentlemen. It's indeed an honor once again to be here and proceeding with the hearings on the political party funding regulations. And on behalf of the Commission, I'd like to welcome all of you and thank you for your continued interest in the representation that has been presented before us. Without further ado, I would like to now request the former Minister for Institutional Development, Mr. Bali Musa, who also would like to share the presentation, his oral presentation. That's Mr. Musa. Welcome. Thank you very much for making this
thank you very much. Good morning, Chairperson, Commissioners, and good morning, Chairperson, Commissioners, and CEO. I'd like to express appreciation that you've given me the opportunity to share a few thoughts with you on the matter before us today. I'd like to start off by making a few comments of a general nature, which I think is important. If we are to have the correct regulations which provide for the implementation of the Act, and I think it's important for us to do it in light of the overall perspective one should have of this Act. The first point to make is that the regulation of political party funding could easily have been a matter provided for in the Constitution of the Republic. At the time of the drafting of the Constitution, there was a point of view held by many that the Constitution itself should have done so. It didn't do so. And my view is that it didn't do so at the time because of the art of the possible. There were many progressive and enlightened provisions that our Constitution has, and at the time when it was adopted in October 1996, it constituted a near-perfect document. Near-perfect because nothing man-made really is perfect. In my view, one of the biggest shortcomings of the Constitution is that it did not regulate the lives of political parties. And so this is, in a sense, an outstanding matter. So when Parliament dealt with this matter and passed the Act, it was actually doing constitutional work. And even though this Act is not an amendment to the Constitution, it is actually legislation of a constitutional nature, in my view. And I think that one has to bear that in mind. And when you're talking about something of a constitutional nature, then it's not designed to deal with matters which appear in the headlines of today. It's really a long-term measure to hardwire our democracy and to deepen our democracy for the long term. It may or may not help with anything that appears, you know, in the newspapers today or tomorrow. and it's not completely relevant. I think it's important for us to do that because we're not trying to solve any particular short-term question that may face us. And so I'd like to make three overall sort of philosophical points, I think, that informed the legislation that we have before us. The first is that political parties are absolutely essential to the functioning of our democracy. Without political parties, the democratic order provided for in the Constitution really doesn't work. They are absolutely essential. They're not nice to haves. So political parties are much more than private clubs or private associations. They are important institutions that belong to society as a whole. And because of the crucial role they have to play, you know, we have, for example, quite a lot of, much is said about the Chapter 9 institutions, or the IEC. It should be properly funded, it should function properly, it should have adequate people, and of course it does all of that, thank you very much. It doesn't go unnoticed at all, the good work that is done. But not much emphasis is placed on political parties. You know, they are so crucial to the functioning of our democracy. So part of what this Act aims to do is to ensure that our political parties can function, that they have integrity, that they are law-abiding, but importantly that they do that they are in fact able to exist, that they are sustainable. Because if our political parties are not internally sustainable with adequate capacity, the wherewithal to function as political parties, then we don't really have political parties, and then our democratic order doesn't work. And as we have it right now, it's a free-for-all. Political parties, in a sense, are left into the wilderness. Sort yourself out. See how you pay your bills, you know. We're not interested in it, in a sense. And I think this is about saying that society collectively owns the political parties, regardless of the party that you vote for and support. So that's it's a general sort of point I'd like to make. The second general point I'd like to make is about the right of citizens to freely vote for the party of their choice. That right would be seriously impaired if it is not a right to freely know what you're voting for. You can have the right to freely vote for the party of your choice, but you should also have, citizens should have the right to know who they're voting for. And perhaps it is the responsibility of the citizen or the voter to make himself or herself knowledgeable of what he's voting for, but it's also a broader responsibility of society and the state and political parties and perhaps also the IEC to inform the voters what they're voting for. The IEC does, for example, a lot of voter education, but you're not really right now in a position to tell people exactly who they're voting for. That such and such party actually belongs to such and such foreign government because they get 90% of their funding from that country, for example. You know, that's sort of the right to know. To know freely who you're voting for, I think that's an important matter that this legislation is aiming to cover. And then the third point is about the sovereignty and integrity of our parliament as the central institution in our democracy. I know every constitutional institution wants to portray itself as the central institution, but Parliament maybe, I think we could say Parliament is the central institution in our democracy. I was once a member of Parliament, so I still have that sort of sentiment. But these are the people that make the laws, that govern all of us. And who controls Parliament? Who's paying those political parties? And right now, I don't think there's much that we don't know. And I'm not suggesting that there are any surprises. You sort of have a general idea of what's going on, who's funding these people and stuff like that. But we're really looking into the future. We're not looking at the current political configuration. We wouldn't want a situation where some or other important political party in parliament receives all of its funding from a foreign government, for example. Because right now it's not illegal for that to happen, and parties have no obligation to tell the voters that they've been funded fully by the government of the United States of America or the government of Russia or whoever else. They have no obligation to do so. But the great danger we have is that foreign governments could be running our parliaments. Theoretically, it's not happening right now. I don't believe for a moment it's happening right now. But I'm saying theoretically that could happen. And if one looks at modern history around the world, it's not inconceivable that these sorts of things can happen. Governments interfere in the electoral processes of other countries. There's a huge accusation right now that Russia has influenced the outcome of the elections in the United States of America, for example. You know, whether it's true or not, but that's of huge global public interest. And we need to protect ourselves against. We need to protect ourselves to ensure that our members of parliament, our represented political parties, and parliament as a whole is responsible to the people of South Africa. I think it's such an obvious thing that it needs repetition, that they're responsible only to the people of South Africa. We wouldn't want a situation where they feel more responsible to a big company that provides most of their funding, or a group of wealthy people who fund most of our political parties. Because if you have that, if you have 90% of the money that goes to our political parties coming from four or five wealthy individuals in the country, you know, it will be hard to believe that the parties don't feel largely responsible to those people. So this is what I think the sovereignty and integrity of parliament, the right of voters to know who they're voting for, otherwise the right to vote becomes a little bit meaningless, and the important place and role of political parties in our overall democracy. I think that's what influences the legislation that we have, and I hope that when you do finalize the regulations, that you would bear that in mind. The regulations were never really aimed at unnecessarily stifling local political activity. I think that's important. I know political parties are concerned about. They're concerned that when a group of volunteers who joined a political party 3 weeks before the election, because typically that's what happens, and they get very excited and go out campaigning, and then maybe, you know, they get a free kumbi ride from somebody from point X to point Y, and they're not really going to be able to easily account for that, and they don't want to be breaking the law because of that and those sorts of things. The Act is not intended to stifle that, and I think it would be a pity if our regulations at the end stifles local political initiative and political activity. So we need to be careful about that. It's not intended about that. So, you know, let's take the example, for example, if you have somebody donating two tubs of Kentucky for the volunteers working on a certain Saturday afternoon in some area. I mean, really, do you really want to know about that, IEC commissioners? I think not. It's of little interest to you. But if somebody is donating two tubs of Kentucky to every branch in the country every day, the same person is donating day after day for the month before the elections, you may be interested. You may think that the voters should know about that. You know, so it's a question of scale and measure. So that's something that needs to be taken into account. The other important matter, which is not really for the IEC, but because the mention was made of the presence of the Treasury here, I should just say that it does have implications for the fiscus. How best to ensure that our political parties remain proper and good political parties is to ensure that they're not in a situation where they've got to scrounge around for money and take it from whoever is willing to give them the money. Is to take them out of this a situation of desperation. And particularly the smaller parties, I must say, are more find themselves in greater desperation than the bigger parties. Because frankly, people like to be, everybody likes to be associated with winners. You know, so it's not, so I think all parties experience that. And the best way to do that is to ensure that a substantial portion of political party funding comes from the public purse. I've done my own rough calculations. None of the parties tell you exactly what their budgets are, but sort of more or less intelligent guesswork from my own years of experience, etc. And I think it's quite affordable for the public purse to be the biggest funder of political parties. I think that can happen, and that gives us as the voters and us as society the biggest assurance, more than any of the regulations and rules and all of those sorts of things, that our political party remains what they should be in a proper democracy. Chair, I don't want to go into any of the details of the regulations themselves, except to say that the simpler the regulations, the better. Secondly, that regulations as they are drafted now, you need to ensure that they are in proper alignment with the Act. I know that style is not always considered to be of essence, but the language and style, it would be better if it speaks to the Act in a better way than it does right now, so that it becomes more easily readable, etc. I think care needs to be taken to ensure that there's nothing ultra-virus in the regulations, and there may be arguably some of that in the Act right now. I'm not sure whether you need a Schedule 1. You already have a list of maximum fines for offences in the Act itself, and whether you want to have another slightly different provision in the regulations. I'm not sure whether you want to have that. So I think that needs to be looked at, and I know others have made comments as far as that is concerned. The final thing I'd like to say, because when I came in here yesterday, some comment was being made about the new fund which is established, which people can contribute into. And there's two questions that arise there. The one is whether, to what extent one should encourage anonymous funding. My own view is that anonymous funding should be discouraged in general. The general default position should be, why would somebody not want you to know that they're giving money? You know, you should ask the question. And why would somebody want to do it in secret? You don't want the media to know, you don't want the voters to know, etc. So the anonymous funding generally, I think, one should be cautious of. But attracting funding from the private sector and from wealthy individuals is something perhaps that it's beyond the authority of the IEC, because, you know, I don't think the IEC wants to become a fundraising organization, but it's something for other institutions like the Treasury to look at more closely, whether there should be tax incentives for persons to donate money to the political party fund. Could it be that you know, such money becomes tax exempt, etc.? So it's something to look at. I know there's always arguments on both sides when it comes to things like that, but overall, I think it probably would be better to incentivize the private sector and wealthy individuals from using some, you know, fiscal measures to donate money to the fund. Thank you, Chairman. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Professor. I did get the signal from Mr. Pichamin that he won't be making it and he's donating his time to you.
He informed me about that too. I can confirm that that is the case.
But since you've been able to make it within your own allocated time, thank you very much for your presentation. And I think my colleagues here are ready to engage and clarify certain things of the input that you've just shared with us. Once more again, thank you very much, and Commissioner.
Thank you very much, and thanks to you, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned the issue that we shouldn't create a situation unnecessarily of burdening political parties with obligations to report the one bucket of chicken. I mean, the branding, of course, of which bucket of chicken might be another reason to report, but let's not go there. I'm not going to mention any brand. But on a more serious note, the concern that has also been raised is the issue about burdensome reporting responsibilities in general. Now, in the scheme of the Act, the idea is that political parties will have will manage their the donations that support their campaigning and their activities into a central banking account. But obviously they've got activities that they run at the most local level, and depending on the political party there will be different structures. And so the scheme of the Act somehow doesn't overtly address that situation. The regulations have, and there is a need to make some, to provide some kind of clarification. The regulations recognize that, but also recognize that for some way to be found to have an overview of everything, even if there is one account that's a monthly or quarterly or whatever it is, statements are collected, it shouldn't necessarily have to be all the accounts, but all the accounts need to be known. I just wonder if you could comment on this match of the scheme of a very decentralized system of operations in, for many things, whether it's donations in kind or it's actual cash issues, and the need to have some kind of centralized overview that says you can actually have comfort that an auditor knows whether or not the 100,000 has been reached or exceeded or whatever. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Yes. Chair, political parties are going to have to up their game. Political parties are going to have to up their game internally. You would assume that the leaders of a political party would themselves want to know and understand what's happening as far as finances are concerned in the party. So, you know, right now, I think most political parties don't have a very good idea themselves of what's happening. And not because they don't want to, it's just how things work, you know, it's just how politics work. And not, nobody's trying to be good or bad about it, but that's the current reality. Political parties will be required to have properly audited financials submitted to the Commission. You cannot audit your financials unless you know what is happening in each and every one of your bank accounts. It cannot be that a political party says that we have a number of small bank accounts that our branches have. We don't know what money goes into that and what money goes out of that. That will have to change. It should have changed already without this Act. you know, political parties, the people who make laws for us, should not have been having such laissez-faire within their parties, but that's what it is. Technically, it's not difficult to do it in today's world, because bank accounts are also highly digitalized, that it's quite easy to have a young, savvy person with a little bit of IT and accounting knowledge to put together all of that information on a daily basis. Political parties can actually quite easily, with simple algorithms, know every day in all their accounts what the cash balances are. Actually, they should want to do that. You know, in the modern age, that's what they should want to do. And it's not a complicated thing to do. It's not a costly thing to do. And you know, my advice to political parties, prepare yourselves. Start getting a situation where on a daily basis you know what your cash balances are, so that your algorithm will pick up that there's a huge sum that went into the account of this branch or this region or this province or something of that sort, and then you can find out what is that about. You know, you just have a ping that goes on your computer screen that tells you that. It's what banks do with all their accounts. In fact, banks have thousands, sometimes millions of accounts, but they're able to pick up almost instantaneously if there's a big sum of money that goes in and out of an account which they can't easily explain, and then, you know, you would get a phone call from your bank. We see there's something happened here. What is that? That's what would generally happen. So it's not a difficult thing to do, but it should be done in any case, because you can't audit your books without knowing that. As far as donations in kind are concerned, that needs to be treated a little bit differently. So if somebody says, okay, I will erect a marquee of 200 square meters so that you can have your rally on a Saturday afternoon here, you don't need to pay me because I'm a funeral undertaker and I've got a number of marquees in any case. Typically that's what happens. And so there's no paperwork, there's no exchange of paperwork, and you don't want to stifle that unnecessarily. But here the onus will be left to the political party. If that same person is erecting thousands of marquees all over the country for the political party, the value of that donation in kind may well exceed millions, and it's up to the political party then to declare that. The onus is with the political party. And so the political party needs to have a mechanism to know what is happening over there. In fact, they should want to know, because it could well be a disreputable entity that's donating that money in kind in order to subvert, you know, the political party at lower level. So it should want to know that in any case. But the onus is there. So if it's one marquee, they don't report it, nothing should happen to them. But if it's thousands of marquees over a period of time from the same donor, you know, then they would be falling foul of this legislation, and the onus would be on them to find out. I don't know if I'm answering your question. Judgment you're referring to is a judgment in a matter which was brought before the courts by My Vote Counts. That is the organization. And at the time of the drafting of the legislation, provision was not made for new political parties that easily, but more particularly for independent candidates at a local level. And quite clearly, you know, some kind of regulatory framework should be applying to those also, but this act didn't go into that. And my vote count in its submission in the final stages of the parliamentary work on this, I remember because I was there, said that they were quite happy with this act to proceed, even though it doesn't cover that, because that requires a little more detailed and specialized treatment of its own, independent candidacy. It's a different creature from a political party altogether. So it's outstanding, it has to be dealt with, and Parliament will have to apply its mind to that. I do believe that there's some thought going into providing for that in the Bahia Act somewhere, but somewhere it has to be provided for. It's an outstanding matter, I would say.
Constitution drafting process was underway in 1993 and then 1996. I'm sure it wasn't envisaged that we would have cyber threats as one of our problems. And as you say, now we're legislating almost constitutionally for the future. So, in your view, do the regulations cater adequately for funding of cyber information that threatens
elections, and this is becoming a fairly tangible threat
following Brexit, and as you mentioned, the
US one? Social media has introduced a completely new dimension in politics worldwide, and my own view is that it's a big part of the explanation for why one has the rise in populism and populist politics in many parts of the world because of social media. Because your traditional political parties would find it very difficult to explain their policies in a Twitter-sized message. Whereas populist parties are able to do so because, you know, because they are populist. I'm not sure, though, that this is a question that's directly related to the funding of political parties. I'm not sure how it would relate to that. Political parties obviously use social media more and more, and they will continue to do so. I'm not sure how it relates to this, because this act doesn't talk about that you may not tell lies about yourself in the media. You know, they shouldn't, they do, but it's not something that's in the purview of this act.
Well, I think the funding comes at two levels. One, the analysis. So in fact, you have all kinds of analytics going to source information. So that comes. And then the messaging arising from the analytics, that comes from the lot. And I think the Brexit, there's a video, YouTube video that's been done, sounds very authentic, that these studies have been done. And we've heard yesterday that arising from the research, that the dark forces, so to speak, tend to use that information plug-in messages to divert and misinform people about in ways that matter to their daily lives so that they vote for me.
Yeah. I got a feeling that some of this will have to be dealt with by the interpretation of the courts of this legislation. because you can't predict all of those sorts of things. So famously in the United States, which does have political party regulation, but you would have entities that would say, we've got nothing to do with the Republican Party. We're not part of the Republican Party. They raise a lot of money and they promote the Republican Party during the elections and the Democratic Party. You know, this is what they do. So you would have, I could say I'm not a member of any political party. I go and raise a lot of money and I place advertisements in a newspaper and say vote for such and such a party. And so it would be undermining the objects of the legislation if one does that. But it's not predictable. Political parties are very inventive if one looks at global experience, and they will think up ways in which to circumvent the legislation, and then that would have to be dealt with. It's actually almost impossible. So when it comes to social media, I think every political party will have people doing its work on social media, pretending that they're not, linked to the party in a sense. And so one would have to deal with that at the time. If it does involve substantial funding, then it would have to be dealt with. And I think our courts are likely then to say that if you raise money outside of the party to promote the party during elections, it's the same thing as party political funding. I think that's what the court is going to at the end of the day. The legislation deals with it, but not with every instance in which it can arise.
So it could arise in the non-disclosure,
failure
to disclose sources of funding, and
might be but typically a political party will say we couldn't disclose because we didn't know these people were promoting our interests. You know, they didn't tell us, and we don't have any objection to people not telling us that they're campaigning for us. You know, there will be, that's typically what happens. But, you can't cover all of that. And so, it will take a bit of time before I think all of these things do get tightened up. But I think the Act and the regulations have sufficient in it right now to catch all of that out, I think. I think we should just give a warning that I think the chances are people will be caught out. Yeah.
Thank you very much for your submission. You begin your submission by making the assertion that the Constitution, when it was created, did not seek to regulate the lives of political parties. What we're beginning to see is yesterday in some of the submissions and the conversation that you just had with my fellow commissioner, it is an attempt to now begin to legislate the lives of political parties through this one act, which is the Party Funding Act. I just would like to have your opinion on another matter that I wrote. It is the issue of political campaigning. Does this conversation that you are having with my fellow commissioner and your opening statement suggest to you that you might very well need a separate piece of legislation that deals with a scheme that regulates political campaigning? And what would your what your sense is?
Yeah. the first part of what you said, I should just mention something that I wanted to say that I forgot to say. And that is that it's actually quite a remarkable thing that 25 years into our democracy, the political parties in Parliament have decided to make an act to regulate themselves and their own funding. It is an absolutely remarkable thing, and as society we should be very appreciative of that. This is legislation that was introduced by the majority party and supported by everybody. When it was voted on finally, not a single member of parliament voted against the bill, and the overwhelming majority voted for Some members of parliament abstained, but an overwhelming majority voted for it. I think that's quite a remarkable thing. And frankly, it gives you as the commission a very strong mandate to proceed with this matter expeditiously and with confidence. As far as political campaigns are concerned, because of the open democracy which we are, I think we will always struggle to deal with the manner in which people campaign. You know, if you say there shouldn't be falsehoods stated in campaigns, there shouldn't be exaggerations, you shouldn't cast aspersions, you shouldn't insult other people and those sorts of things, you come so close to impacting on freedom of speech that it becomes very difficult. You know, an open democracy has its downsides, you know. It's sort of sometimes not an offense to insult somebody, you know, or to say somebody which a person may take offense, especially if you're in public life, if you're the leader of a political party or something of that sort. So I think that the campaigning, what would be something that we should look at, but it's so new in the world, it's this whole thing of fake news. And there the public and the voters do need protection, because the voters genuinely sometimes believe in things that never actually happened, you know, around, not just South Africa, but around the world. In fact, in the wealthy, developed countries, it's happening even more so. You know, I believe that Brexit would not have had the support it has had it not been for the fake news that has been dished out to the citizens of the UK. So how we deal with it, I don't know, it's too new for us to work out. But I think you as a commission, you would need to apply your mind to it, because you're there to protect the voter. So you want the voter now to know who are the funders behind the political parties they want to vote for, so that they can take an informed decision. But what about the voter believing in things that never happened, which is what's happening with fake news? Maybe I'm just too old to even know where to start with the social media stuff, because I don't do much of it myself. But it's something that needs to be thought about, because I think you can see the danger worldwide that's going to happen. In fact, in many other countries, we're lucky our voters haven't rejected our traditional political parties. But in many countries, the voters have just rejected the traditional political parties and voted for, I mean, literally clowns, you know, in one or two instances. And so that could happen. Yes, that is my opinion, and I think that it's what this Act does. This Act places limits, and it curtails the ability of political parties to raise funding from private sources. It is, in essence, that's what it does. And I think the other side of the coin is that the funding from the public purse should be material and should be substantial. I would feel, now that I'm just an ordinary citizen, I would feel much more comfortable if our political parties depend for most of their money on the state, because then I think we as society will have more grounds and more levers to ensure that we hold them accountable. So I think that it's the direction in which it should go. I know that there are people who thought, you know, we're not a rich country, can we afford it, you know, we've got lots of other needs, etc. But I think the actual budgets of political parties, the size of the budgets, I think the public, some people, have an exaggerated idea of how much. Political parties generally live on a shoestring. They're hand to mouth. They live hand to mouth generally. That's all of them. And I think I know quite a bit about how they function. So I don't think that it's going to break the bank if we are a little more easy on that.
Chair, good morning, and thank you very much for the opportunity. So maybe let me just upfront apologize for the president of BUSA, Mr. Sepobijana, for not being able to make it this morning. He advised me that he sent a notice indicating that he's not going to be able to make it. And after the NEDLAC conversation, yesterday he therefore requested me to make this representation here this morning on behalf of all of them. And maybe just as a way of background, Chair, if you allow me, I'm the CEO of BLSA, but I'm a board member of BUSA as well. So you would know that BUSA represents about 60 industry bodies and associations, one of which is Business Leadership South Africa. Business Leadership South Africa is an organization represents big business. We are the only organization of CEOs in the country, and our membership is about 86 CEOs of JSC listed companies. So I therefore sit here not just on behalf of Business Leadership South Africa, but as a BUSA board member, and therefore making that representation from that perspective. So, Chair, as BUSA and broader business, we welcome the promulgation of the Political Party Funding Act. I think you would know that we've been very vocal about the corruption and the lack of ethical leadership that has costed this country what we now term the lost decade. The reason why we find ourselves in this economic crisis is precisely because we have allowed corruption to run as rampant as it has run. And when I say this, I'm not only talking about in the public sector, I'm talking about in the private sector as well, because I think we are very much aware that with each corruption there is a corrupter and corruptee. And I think the public sector would not have been able to embark on this industrial scale looting and whatever corruption if us as business were not complicit. So it is therefore from that perspective that we think that the promulgation of this act is progressive, it forces us as business as well, to be honest, and I think it forces us to start conducting ourselves and our affairs in a manner that is ethical. So we look forward to the speedy implementation of the Act. And the Act for us really addresses a number of concerns that have been raised on political party funding for numerous years. So the first one, Chair, is that of transparency. And the second one, we like the fact that political parties are now going to be legally bound to disclose all funding above 100,000, and I think I'll come back to this one. We note the maximum amount of 15 million that a single individual can donate to a political party in 1 year. I'll come back to this one as well, because I think there might have to be an issue around thresholds. Because if we allow such huge amounts to go through the system again, you know, I'm worried that then we might be opening ourselves up for that which we're trying to prevent by the promulgation of this Act. We, however, are very happy about the Multi-Party Democracy Fund. Because we think that with the introduction of this fund, then you allow those who are in favor of the promotion of our democracy and our constitution, and without actually supporting any political party. Because I think, let's agree, what we have in the country at the moment, you know, in the form of a lot of rising voices from a political perspective is progressive. You don't want to have one dominant party which doesn't have, you know, a strong opposition. We think this opposition creates the diversity and the richness that you see in politics today. So therefore, from a business perspective, we know that we normally say that ours has got nothing to do with politics. We normally say that the business of business is business. But we also understand that politics determine economics. We also understand that the biggest constraint of any country's economic growth is its political economy. So if you therefore want to contribute to the vibrancy of the country and promote a strong political economy, you therefore want to support politics. So this fund therefore gives us an opportunity as business to not have to bet on a particular horse, but rather to bet on the spirit, you know, of the democracy and its promotion, therefore. And I think we're looking forward to its development, and we like the way it's going to be constructed and the fact that the IEC will therefore be the arbiter in terms of ensuring that it gets administrated the way it ought to be administrated. The donation in the form of assets we think is a very critical one, and we think that it's necessary that this must be disclosed as well, so we welcome that. The organs of state and the OSOEs are prohibited from donating to political parties, and we think this is progressive as well. I think, Chair, we need to get to a point in this country where we understand why we have state-owned entities. We need to get to a point in this country where we understand that the money that are collected from taxpayers for a particular purpose ought to be used for that particular purpose. So I think having your SOEs, and especially at this time in our country where our SOEs are such an albatross around our necks, you know, where the exposure that we have in the country in the form of government guarantee, you know, is the biggest thing in this, you know, with ESCOM being the sovereign risk, you know, in this country. I don't think we can continue to have our SOEs, you know, actually donating to political parties. It is not their business, but for a particular mandate, and I think that they should focus on that mandate. And the donations, we welcome the fact that the donations can also only be made for political purposes, and any individual receiving a donation is deemed to have received it for the party, so there should be no personal gain. We would, however, urge the IEC to take on this responsibility in as far as the Multi-Party Democracy Fund is concerned, so that the objectives of the legislation are efficiently met and not compromised as a result of capacity and resource constraints. We have acknowledged that the Act is a good beginning in addressing issues related to political party funding, but we note that the thresholds that are given, and I'm talking about the 100,000 and the 15 million, are maybe rather too high, and would urge that in the South African context in particular, and what we have just undergone as a country, these should be revised. We also would like to implore that we look at the legislation that needs to be put in place to safeguard to ensure an individual does not get past the threshold and report him by using different legal entities to donate multiple amounts below the threshold. And I think on this one, Busa and business in general, Chair, are looking forward to the implementation of this, and we are keen to working with the IEC to assist in socializing this legislation amongst our membership base, and we look forward to engaging with that issue at the appropriate time. And I think let me pause there, Chair, and take questions or comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Indication that
Vice Chair, thank you very much. So yes, as business we would welcome that kind of tracking and exposure, because as I said in my submission that we welcome this act because of its transparency. And I say that knowingly that probably one of the things that we are good at as business, when some of these pieces of legislation come out that we think are going to be problematic to advance our own agenda, we immediately come up with ways of how we are going to circumvent it. And I'm talking about a whole lot of policies that we ought to be complying with, but there is a very, you know, there are a lot of clever ways, you know, that we are bypassing these very policies. Triple B legislation, I think, is one of those, you know, that business has embarked on this as a TikTok exercise. But I think we also realize that we are at a critical time, stage and point in our country, and we need to start engaging with these things from a different perspective. Because I think let's agree that if we are going to continue doing what we've always done, then unfortunately the results and the changes that we'd like to see as a country and a society are not going to be achieved. So if BUSA and BLSA have to assist actually with the implementation, you know, of this tracking mechanism, you know, if it means it's going to be financial support or human resource support or technological support or whatever the case is, we would like for it to be implemented, because therefore it advances that we have been on for the past 3 years to say that it is about time that we actually look at rooting out, or rather instilling ethical and moral leadership, you know, because it is the ethics and the moral degeneration that has actually led this country to where it is. So we are in support of that, Vice Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, I just need help. Probably you may not, you may choose not to answer it today, but there's something that I'm struggling to think about, just in the thinking process. If you look at the company tax, you look at what you alluded to, the transformative mechanisms that come with the BEE codes, you know, the 1%, et cetera, et cetera. And then the suggestion of tax incentives. I think there might be value in putting all of those things together and looking at the slate of the transformative role of business, and to think through that, and also it might help us plug the gaps in terms of where we're going with this futuristic provisions. So I think what I am asking for is that we begin to have conversations around all of those instruments that we have available, taxation, codes, tax incentives, etc., and begin to talk more about, much more robustly, about the transformative role of business. I think it's more of an ask as opposed to a question.
Yeah. Yes. Commissioner would definitely welcome that as business, because I think, again, maybe let's agree and submit that business can only prosper in a prosperous society. And that, and this that we have at the moment is a fundamentally flawed society. There's no country that can actually survive or prosper, you know, with this 10% of the citizens that are opulent, 40% that is in the middle class, and more than half of your citizens, which is more than 50%, that are living in abject poverty. And I think we've been allowed to get away with this as business, you know, for many years now. But therefore, you look at that and you say, maybe it's difficult to get KK to be excited about Christmas. You therefore have to say, what is the role of government? If we have all these policies and all these penalties that are implicit in these policies, but then for whatever reason we have not done what we're supposed to do with business, and we even are so arrogant to say that we're actually going to be budgeting for these penalties. But you hardly find any companies that actually do get penalized, you know, for not complying with this legislation. So I think the role, therefore, of the policymakers has to come in to say that we need to understand that the government of, or rather the business of government is to make tough decisions. And we've been left to run amok for the past 25 years as business, and that is why you find ourselves, you know, where we are as a country. Because conditions for people to prosper are not God-given. You know, government has to make sure that through macroeconomic policies, they push the country in a particular territory. So if you're going to leave one sector, you know, of the society and of the, you know, social partners to do as they please, then you sit with this that you're sitting with as a country. So I absolutely agree with you. We need to look at a holistic way in terms of what is business's role going to be in fundamentally transforming this society. Because the biggest ticking time bomb, in my view, that we have in this country is that of inequality. And I'm afraid, and I tell this to my CEOs, I'm afraid that this fight and this war is going to be very quickly brought to our doorstep. The way you saw Alexander crossing the M1 bridge into Sandton about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And for me, that was very telling to say that they could have taken this march anywhere else, but they chose to take it into Sandton. So as business, we ought to be sitting up and listening to say, what is this calling for? What posture do we need to be assuming? The lens through which we engage with transformation broadly needs to be different. We cannot continue doing what we've always done and expect a different result. So it's a long way, you know, Commissioner, of saying that I absolutely agree.
I feel tempted just to ask this question that Max will ask. One of the tenets of liberal democracy and capitalism, which this country is, capitalist country, is that the market forces will correct. Now, we sit here 25 years down the line of democracy. We are grappling with the question of the funding of to borrow from the previous presenter, Mr. Musa, the lifeblood of our democracy, being the political parties. Now, how does business look at this question? Because now, in a ideal free market environment, regulation is the least thing that should come, because business, being in the market and being in business of sustaining the free market, would be saying we will self-regulate the issue of funding of the political parties. But I haven't, and I stand to be corrected, I haven't heard any time in the 25 years when business was actually deliberating and discussing that fundamental question as to how do we as business regulate ourselves with respect to a so critical engagement and involvement with the life line or the lifeblood of our democracy. And we know this process is a product of civil society actually taking this issue to the forefront, business society. Can you share with us? We welcome where business and what business is doing. But I'm asking that there's a question of philosophical side about free market and self-regulation, and then the other, what accounts for these 25 years of the vacuum from business? Thank you.
Chair, the short answer is that business was not led by me. So Chair, on a serious note, and I absolutely agree with you, and I think hence I made the statement earlier on that it's difficult to try and get Turkey to be excited about Christmas. But let's also agree that there is no purist system in the West. So there can't be a pure capitalist system. There can't be a pure free market system. Neither can there be a pure communist or socialist system. It has to be a mix of the two. And I think this is where, through macroeconomic policy, government comes in to ensure that the country is sustainable. So to move towards, for instance, and maybe let me make this example. When this triple BE legislation, and I'm going to use that policy, because I think we brought in triple BE as a country because we were very much aware that it is going to be the tool that we are going to use to normalize our society, because this that we're sitting with in this country is fundamentally abnormal. So if you agree that that is what the objective and the purpose of triple BE was, we were very clear back then when the Employment Equity Act in particular was enacted in 1998, to say that let there be a time frame on this Employment Equity Act. Let there be tax. You know, let there be clear guidelines in terms of when are we going to enter this thing, when are we going to exit it. You know, how long is it going to take us to move the society to a particular direction so that we achieve what we want to achieve? Because we can't be talking about transformation, you know, 25 years later. And when you look at where we're sitting at the moment, we are nowhere near a transformed society. We are nowhere near the businesses that I lead, you know, representing the demographics of the South African population, and that is fundamentally flawed. So this is where, therefore, through macroeconomic policy, you know, government comes in. Because if you understand that, and I think the problem for me is that I don't think we ever defined what it was that we were solving for when we came into this thing 25 years ago. I don't think the problem statement was clear. I don't think we understood that we are working towards a sustainable economy and what a sustainable economy looks like. And in my view, a sustainable economy is one that is going to bulge in middle class, where you have 80% of your population that is actually going to be sitting in the middle class. Because we know that it is the middle class that sustains economies, not the rich. So, but then, if you don't have a clear problem statement when you begin putting whatever interventions in place, then you already see that this thing is going to be a hit and miss. And therefore, that is why you have left business to self-regulate the way it has self-regulated, and it has led us nowhere. Instead, a lot of people are saying that maybe, just maybe, our lives were much better in the apartheid system than what we are confronted with, you know, in this democracy. So I think the short answer is that business, as I've said, is in the business of business. Business is in the business of profits. But the government ought to come in through regulation, through policy, to steer all of us as different constituencies and different social partners towards a particular direction. I don't think we can afford to have superstars in this country or super constituencies in this country that are going to be left to do as they please. But for whatever reason, in the South African context, we have allowed it and we are sitting where we're sitting. So I don't know, therefore, who can say that, you know, why has business not done business has done what has come naturally to them, you know, for the past 25 years, because it is just in the nature of business to do that. So there was supposed to have been an intervention and someone pointing them in the right direction. And in my view, that is what the role of government is. Because as I said earlier on, the role of the conditions for people to prosper, just like you saw in the apartheid era, there were interventions that were deliberately put in place to move the white population towards a particular direction. The problem statement was very clear that we were solving for the poor African problem. And they did that in 40 years. So what was our problem statement when we came into this democracy in 1994? And even if we had a clear problem statement, did we put interventions in place to ensure that we achieved that? Did we put timelines to ensure that we achieved that? And my view is that we did not. That's why we're sitting where we're sitting as a country 25 years into democracy.
Commission would like to thank you, Madam Officer, for your input and the spirited engagement that is enriching this process. And once more, again, thank you very much. Thank you.